I can't believe I'm doing another video on this topic, but over my Discord server, the commenter, Lurs, thank you, Lurs, pointed out something that I had forgotten to talk about in my last video, namely that if there was a domestic conflict in the United States, there's a good likelihood there would be mass starvation. And that's part of, and there's several reasons why. Part of it's because of how our farming industry works, but also part of it is because of how our shipping industry works. You know, most agriculture in the United States is done by mega corporation farms. And in large areas, those farms will only grow a specific type of crop. And a lot of that's just cash crops, maize or rapeseed, that kind of thing. And of course, the average American doesn't know how to grow any food should the food supply be cut off. But in the event of a civil war, the farmers that work on there are going to run home to their families. So those farms are going to shut down. And actually, I've seen some good arguments on the internet that if a second civil war broke out in the United States, there would probably be a lot of defectors from the military, because they would want to go home and protect their families because they know how bad things would get. A lot of our food, once it's grown and harvested, it's then shipped several times around the country, usually first to a storage facility, then shipped again to a manufacturing plant in another part of the country. Think of like a giant flour mill, and then shipped maybe a second or third time to manufacturing areas just to make it edible. In other words, not just the U.S. economy, but even just the food distribution part of it. Well, the food manufacturing and distribution part of it is dependent on a massive logistical network. You know, and in the event of a domestic conflict, are the roads going to be safe? Probably not. Is shipping going to be able to happen? Maybe not. You know, if you look at a map of the United States, there's about five or six major highways crisscrossing the whole thing, you know, going from one coast to the other. Either taking control of them or just putting a big hole in the middle of them would help to shut down shipping around the United States. Also, I'd add to that a lot of our grocery stores rely on just-in-time delivery. You know, they don't keep overstock in the back. You know, once the food's gone from the grocery stores and shipping shuts down, well, there's no more coming, even if the farms are still producing food, and that's assuming the farm is still producing food. But the problem gets worse because the majority of Americans, they don't know how to grow. Not only do they not know how to grow their own food, they wouldn't know how to work as farm workers. You know, they work in a service economy. This is a majority of Americans. So you might have 100 to 200 million people who are practically useless in all of this. Not just that, and useless in the sense that they can't fight. They're not physically fit, or they're physically unfit, actually. Like, what is it, 70% of Americans are overweight or obese. Most aren't going to know how to grow food. They have no practical skills outside of the specialized service economy. And this, when I say service economy, I'm not just talking, don't just imagine Starbucks baristas. You know, how many IT guys would know how to shoot straight or clean an AR-15 or know how to plant and grow crops? Probably very, very few. If you're one of the regimes vying for power in the United States, who are you going to give your food to? Are you going to give it to your soldiers and to your workers? And by workers, I mean people like industrial workers or maybe car mechanics who can keep vehicles running, or plumbers, or the people who are growing what little food is left. Who are you going to give your food to? And to them and their families, of course. But everyone else who had skills that once maybe even commanded high salaries, now they're effectively useless in the new economy, the new wartime economy. I mean, maybe they'll get rations or something, but... And of course, people are going to notice this kind of thing is happening. Do you think, you know, assuming it's only a two-sided conflict, which it probably wouldn't be, I'll get to that in a second, it would completely make sense for either Team Red or Team Blue to use famine as a weapon of war against the other side. Try to knock out whatever farms they have, the farms that are working that they have left. Try to knock out their ability for shipping. But it wouldn't just be a two-sided conflict. You would also have local gangs, local cartels, local militias, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, town by town. You would have a lot of different factions all fighting for power. You saw that kind of thing in Yugoslavia. And that would actually probably be a pretty good place to read about, to have an idea of the kind of thing that would happen if America broke down into a domestic conflict. And that's not to mention the influence that foreign powers would want to have in the United States. You know, foreign powers from all around the world would almost certainly attempt to intervene in any kind of domestic conflict. So it's not going to be two factions fighting each other. It's probably going to be 60 factions or more fighting. Well, if you break it down to the local level, maybe more than, you know, 60 factions all fighting one another. you know, from your local street gangs, your local militias, your local cartels, and then you move it up a level and maybe have some statewide forces fighting each other. And then at a national level, you have the larger, if it's only two main fighting forces fighting one another. And from what I remember, and for those of you who are in the know, let me know in the comment section below, I believe most wartime deaths are not actually from direct combat. It's from everything else. It's from disease, from starvation, that kind of thing. And speaking of diseases, you know, if our shipping network shut down, that means medicines are not going to be shipped. If power gets shut down, well, some hotels might have backup generators or something, or maybe they could be hooked up to portable generators. But even then, they're going to be triaging patients. A lot of people who are already sick or the elderly are not going to get the care that they need. Think about diabetes. About 30 million adults aged 18 or over have diabetes in the United States. Well, if our shipping shuts down, will they be able to get the insulin they need? Probably not. And I think back to that Joe Rogan podcast with the Navy SEAL, him talking about looking at the escalating political violence. And not, he doesn't like what he's seeing. And then he said the last thing he wants to see is domestic conflict in the United States. It probably because he's thinking about things like this, because he's been in the war zones where he's seen these kinds of things. And that's the kind of thing I wish that he would have spelled out in more detail. Because when people think of wartime, they're thinking of soldiers fighting each other. They're not thinking of the civilian starving to death on the side of the road, or, you know, the adult whose leg has rotted off because of diabetes. Have you ever seen what happens to someone who has uncontrolled diabetes? They look like a walking zombie, like parts of their body look like it's decomposing. So what, we're going to have 30 million Americans walking around literally decomposing in front of our eyes? That's why in the last video I suggested that if such a conflict was to break out in the United States, it would probably have to be very targeted, targeted towards individuals, not large-scale armies fighting one another. Well, a conflict that doesn't mean just the end of the United States in general. That it would have to have institutional support. In other words, it would have to be a limited conflict. It couldn't be total war. Unless, of course, you want to end the United States. I mean, if that's your goal, then, you know, go for total war. And in that Joe Rogan podcast with the Navy SEAL, he also said something else. He said, I don't see a way out of this, the current situation we're in. Outside of us getting a Caesar, I don't see a way out either. All the content on this channel is free, and if you like the work that I do, there's donation options in the description box below. So thank you for watching, and don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Joe Rogan recently had a Navy SEAL on his podcast, and they were talking about the escalating political violence and how there's some people that really want an American Civil War 2.0 in our country. Now, I kind of cringe when I say Civil War 2, so I'm not going to probably use that phrase again through this video, but that's what I'm talking about, okay? And since that podcast came out, there's been a lot of more videos talking about you-know-what. And there's been plenty of shitposting on social media, as well as people kind of wargaming it in their heads as to how things would play out. But if you think about the current situation that we're in, I suspect that any kind of armed conflict in the United States would not play out the way people seem to be envisioning it. First of all, we don't have two standing armies. Second of all, our institutions are largely intact. So if armed conflict were to happen, I suspect it would look something more like two insurgencies fighting each other. So largely civilian fighting, or maybe retired military veterans fighting. And even with that, they probably wouldn't be fighting the way armies normally fight, where they take and hold territory, because they could capture institutions instead. And not just that, why send in troops when you could just send in drones to strike a target, I mean? Let me paint a picture for you here of America being so polarized that red insurgency and blue insurgency not only arise, but they receive some institutional support from different elements of our local and federal governments. Because for the way it looks, it does look like our local and federal governments are divided among Team Red, in broad terms, among Team Red and Team Blue. So imagine red insurgency living in Red County in some state in the United States, approaches Red County Sheriff and says, hey, we're living here and let's cut a deal. You know, we'll donate to your retirement fund or something. And you're going to look the other way for the kind of stuff that we do here, because you support Team Red anyhow. And over in Blue County, something similar happens. Blue insurgency approaches a local blue sheriff and says, "Hey, we live here. Here, you know, we're gonna send some money to your retirement fund or whatever. And you support Team Blue anyway, so you should support us." So Red insurgency strikes targets in Blue County. Blue insurgency strikes targets in Red County. Both have at least support from the local sheriff in the sense that they're willing to look the other way. You know, pretend like you don't know where the guys are hiding out, that kind of thing. Or maybe even feed intelligence or give warnings to your local friendly neighborhood insurgency. So if Red insurgency decides to strike a target in Blue County, well, they could send in one of their death squads, but why do that when civilian drones can carry payloads? Or you can go on YouTube and look at videos of drones that have firearms attached to them. Now, these could be used for targeted assassinations. You wouldn't have to actually, you know, blow up buildings, because with the modern internet era, you can use tools of the internet to find out local leaders of your political opposition. You know, John Doe is the local leader of Democrats for World Peace. So you send in your drone, you get his home address, and you send in your drone with his explosive package and take off his head when he's trying to drive to work in the morning. And Blue insurgency would do the same thing. They would get the home addresses of political leaders of their opposition. So maybe it's Jane Doe of the Republican National or the Republican Local Gun Club, whatever. And they send in drones, a drone with a bomb package to take her out on her morning commute to work. But again, when I say drones, you're probably thinking of like the drone helicopters. Nah. Well, why? You don't have to do that. You know, there's remote controlled cars that you are so big they use gasoline. It might be even easier for them to carry a explosive payload on them. You remote control them, you hook up a camera to it, send in the drone, drive it underneath Jane Doe's car, blow the whole thing up. Take out the leadership of your political opposition. Let's not forget that WikiLeaks, one of the things that they released was a big old spreadsheet of all the top DNC donors. And that has people's home addresses. You can sort that thing by state. Think global, act local, that kind of thing. And why would you attack these kinds of people? Well, there's a saying that goes something like, the weakest part of the M1 Abrams tank is the man who refuels it. Well, the weakest part of your political opposition are the people who vote for it. And since our institutions are still largely intact, voting still matters. You start knocking out the people who coordinate and organize voting drives, or you take out the voters themselves, the other side starts losing institutional support because their people are not getting elected. Or let's imagine another scenario. You know, election time comes up, could be for local or national politician, and typically they hold rallies where a bunch of people get together. Well, one way to make sure that your opponent doesn't win is by eliminating the voters themselves. So the local political rally is being held, say it's on First Street. So what you do, once everyone is in place, is you send in your drones or maybe even remote-controlled cars. And when I say remote-controlled cars, I don't necessarily mean the little RC cars. I mean, like, you can find YouTube videos of people actually hooking up equipment to full-size automobiles and remote-control driving them. You know, drive that into the northern end of First Street with a payload in it. Payload goes off. You know, the cops are running, the cops and paramedics are running towards where the explosion was to help the wounded and the injured. And, you know, you look at your map and you realize, well, the most likely exit for most civilians is going to be towards the south. Okay, well, on the southern end of that, of First Street, you have your death squads waiting. But your death squads aren't carrying, well, some of them probably carry rifles, but most of them are not going to be carrying rifles. They're going to be carrying flamethrowers. Again, you can go online and look, and you can build there's homemade flamethrowers that you can build that are rather effective. So you got your guys, you got your flame troops ready, and you're using flamethrowers not just because they're area of effect weapons, but because they're also weapons of terror. So the civilian voter crowd's moving south, your death squad shows up with the flamethrowers, people get burned, no one likes getting burned, they turn around, the group at the southern end of First Street panic, turn around, try to run north, probably going to get trample deaths that way too. You know, you have these kinds of attacks happen during rallies. Well, first of all, people stop holding rallies, so there'll be fewer voters that would actually turn out. Second of all, you would eliminate the voters, so that's one less vote for the opposition to get elected. And I was thinking about flamethrowers because if I remember correctly, I think it was in the First World War. I'm not sure if it was the first or second. I believe it was Germany deployed platoons of flame troops that were very effective. I don't remember that off the top of my head. In the comments below, let me know what the hell I'm talking about. Thanks. And this would just be the direct physical confrontations that the two sides could have. Things could escalate also in other ways by using tools of the criminals use, like identity theft. You know, you have some political leader on the other side. Maybe it's an actual politician. Maybe it's just someone who organizes voters to get out the vote. And you steal their identity. You wreck their credit. Better yet, if their mortgage is held at a local friendly bank, you do whatever you can and whatever you have to get their mortgage canceled. Even if you have to use shady means to get it done, even if it ends up going to court and comes back and says the court says, no, actually, nothing was wrong with this. The guy's house should not have been foreclosed upon. Well, that's still going to tie someone up for 6 months or more, maybe years for that matter. So you may not have physically eliminated the person, but you've distracted them enough that they might turn away from politics. And that's one less person to organize voters. That's one less person to get elected. At a national level, if some of our institutions decided to support red or blue insurgency, you know, maybe the FBI provides intelligence to blue insurgency. Maybe the special forces provides direct training to red insurgency and equipment, you know, something along those lines. Because I suggest this because if you look at the way things are now, it does look like our institutions are divided against themselves. It doesn't look like they're all on the same team. And then, of course, another problem would arise is if this kind of violence broke out in America, would politicians move for suspending elections? Maybe. Maybe they would. What would happen then? You know, would that cause both blue and red, maybe not to revolt, but like regular people who don't want to be involved in the physical conflict, you know, you might end up with massive protests. Hey, don't you dare suspend elections. And of course, I assume protests and the protesters that would show up would depend on, you know, where they live. If it's a bunch of Democrats in a red county, they're going to protest the suspension of elections there. And if it's a bunch of Republicans in blue county, they're going to protest the suspension of elections there. And if this kind of thing got rolling, well, there'd also be a massive money incentive for all of this. Let's say you're part of blue insurgency and you've got a deal with a blue county sheriff. So blue insurgency sneaks into red county. One day at 2 a.m., they decide to perform a raid on a red county jewelry store, break in, steal all the jewelry, get back out to their safe haven in blue county. And with the cooperation of blue county sheriff, they could start fencing that jewelry for, you know, cash and prizes. Of course, the question would be at an institutional level, let's say you capture the local mayor, local governor. Could the local mayor or governor somehow funnel money towards red or blue insurgency? Yeah, maybe, depending on exactly how they carve up the budget. But the fighting doesn't just have to be the physical level. It could also be at the institutional level. Let's say a internet pipeline runs through blue county into red. Okay, well, maybe they decide to cut off the internet to red county, or they double the price of internet in red county. So red county decides to retaliate. Well, our water pipe from the local lake goes through red county into blue county. We can either shut off the water or double or triple the price for people living in blue county to pay for water. And one of the worst parts about this kind of scenario is, since the institutions are largely still intact, since it would probably be difficult to have a decisive victory, this could drag on for a long, long time. You know, imagine the troubles in Northern Ireland, plus 21st century technology, plus the cooperation of some of the institutions. That kind of thing could go on for decades. You know, if you compare it to the troubles in Northern Ireland, that conflict started somewhere in the 1960s and didn't end until the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. 1998, that's almost 40 years. Do you think that America has 40 years of fight in it? Yeah, probably. You know, with both sides going for institutional capture, looting, knocking out the other side's voters, when you're not going to have the kind of decisive victories that you would in an actual conflict, like, you know, compare that to the American military capturing a city in Iraq. You know, if the troubles in Northern Ireland went on for 40 years, could it go on for 40 years in America? Or longer? could it be could it go on for so long that it almost seems like a permanent institution in America? So what I'm getting at with all of this, and like I started the video with, is that if armed conflict breaks out in the United States, it doesn't have to look the way people are expecting. It doesn't have to be two standing armies fighting one. I mean, we don't even have two standing armies willing that would be able to fight one another. It could be red insurgency versus blue insurgency with institutional support that go for the capture of institutions or for eroding the voting base of the other team. And of course, our institutions might split up among team red versus team blue. And I don't just mean institutions like the FBI or the CIA. I mean like banks. You know, blue bank is not going to let someone from red team have an account there. Red bank's not going to allow someone from blue team to have an account there. We would effectively split into two separate countries that are still stuck together. So what do you guys think about armed conflict in the United States? Let me know in the comment section below. All the content on this channel is free, and if you like the work that I do, there's donation options in the description box below. So thank you for watching, and don't forget to like, subscribe, and share.
Jonathan Roth. Mr. Roth will today talk about, is civil war coming to America? Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Mr. Roth.
Thank you. Well, it's a real privilege to speak with all of you today about this topic. Is the United States about to engage in another civil war? And first, let's just go over some facts. So Rasmussen Polling, which is a polling company in the United States, did some polling last month. And roughly 31% of likely U.S. voters say it's likely that the U.S. will experience a second civil war at some point in the next 5 years. So one in three people in the United States. Almost 60% of all voters in the U.S. are concerned that those opposed to Trump's policies will resort to violence. And there's no question that Americans are becoming far more partisan in their views. The Pew Research Center, which is another very, very reputable polling company, conducted a study last year, and it was titled The Partisan Divide on Political Values Grows Even Wider. And essentially what the crux of what they were saying was that more are now on the left and the right politically in the, within the spectrum, holding with fewer holding a mix of positions. So there used to be a time where you could be a right winger, but you might hold some left wing positions and vice versa. Well, that has hardened where the right is on the right, the left is on the left, and they don't mix. They don't mix. In other words, political positions are most definitely hardening. In late 2016, Vice News released a documentary titled The House Divided. And I don't know if anyone's seen this documentary, but if there's anything you could do with your time later on today or later this week, go watch it. It's on YouTube. It is a stunning film. It is extremely well produced. Essentially, all the major political players of the last decade in the United States are in it, from Obama, Pelosi, McConnell wasn't in it, but John Boehner and Eric Cantor and such. And essentially, it's a dissection of what's happening in the United States politically. And there's this exchange that happens towards the end of the film, and I want to take a quote there, because the first time I saw it, I had to stop and go back and watch it again, because it was so, I just thought it was so, A, scary, and B, profound. And it was an exchange between Shane Smith, he's an owner of Vice News, but he was the reporter in this film, and Frank Luntz, who, if any of you know who he is, he's a Republican pollster. He's very famous in the United States, probably the most famous pollster in the country today. And Smith asks him this question. He says, if it's toxic, and he's referring to the political system in the U.S., and it can't be fixed, where does American politics go from here? And this is Luntz's reply. He says, that's why I tell people I'm going to New Zealand, and I'm going to buy 15 acres somewhere, and I'll sell off 14. So if you want to buy an acre, let me know. And it cuts to Shane Smith, and you just kind of see him, what, are you kidding here? And then Luntz says, no, I'm not kidding. I'm going in December. At some point, and this is where what he said, I just thought, I can't believe somebody as mainstream and establishment as him is saying this. At some point, the economy just stops functioning. The Greeks did not survive. The Romans did not survive. The French did not survive. The British did not survive. Why should we think the American Empire will survive? I don't know, and I unfortunately will probably still be alive, I wish I wasn't, when this whole thing comes tumbling down. This is the most mainstream pollster in the United States saying this in a very public forum. A lot of political commentators and figures are saying, obviously, the civil war is around the corner, or they're at least soft-pedaling some sort of violent political action. In foreign policy, you may have seen this. Foreign Policy is a very very mainstream establishment foreign policy magazine. If you want to know what the establishment's thinking, you need to read it. In March 2017, so just roughly just over a year ago, Keith Mines, he's a former U.S. Special Forces officer and a diplomat, posted to a whole bunch of countries that have gone through internal civil strife. He wrote an article, and basically what he said was he predicted, based on his experience working overseas, that there's a 60% chance of civil war in America within the next 10 to 15 years. Steve King, he's a Republican congressman, and he's a bit of a blowhard at times, but back in June, he was commenting on the protests taking place at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Holding Facility in Portland, Oregon, which is ICE. And I'm sure you've all heard of ICE, especially over the last month. On Twitter, he said the following. He said, America's heading in the direction of another Harper's Ferry. After that comes Fort Sumter. And he said this publicly. So if you need any bit of a history lesson, essentially, Harper's Ferry was the first violent action that led directly to the Civil War, and obviously Fort Sumter is where the first shots of the Civil War occurred. Commentator Dennis Prager, a right-winger, believes America's already in a second Civil War. Americans are more divided today, morally, ideologically, and politically, than they were during the Civil War. Several members of the Trump administration, we've all seen this, being kicked out of restaurants and such. Maxine Waters, Democratic Congresswoman, you've heard what she's been saying, essentially saying that Trump needs to be resisted and ultimately impeached, and that Trump administration officials should be harassed. And I'm going to guess in this room, a pretty sophisticated audience, I'm going to guess that many of you saw this. A day after Maxine Waters said what she said, the Trump administration officials needed to be harassed, Splinter News, which is a media company owned by Univision, which is has an audience comprised of American Latinos and Hispanics. Splinter News' senior writer, a guy by the name of Noah Hamilton, he wrote an article, and the title of the article was, "This is Just the Beginning." And this is a bit of what he said. Read a recent history book. The U.S. had thousands of domestic bombings per year in the 1970s. This is what happens when citizens decide en masse that their political system is corrupt, racist, and unresponsive. The people out of power have only just begun to flex their dissatisfaction. The day will come sooner than you all think when Trump administration's officials will look back fondly on the time when all they had to worry about was getting hollered at a Mexican restaurant. And then earlier this week, President Obama was in Johannesburg and Joburg in South Africa, and he was delivering the annual Nelson Mandela lecture. He said many interesting things, but this is one that I pulled out from what he said. And because you'll notice that he's beginning to be more vocal about what's happening in D.C. Obama said, look at history, look at the facts. The fact that countries which rely on rabid nationalism and xenophobia and doctrines of tribal and racial or religious superiority as their main organizing principle, the thing that holds people together, eventually those countries find themselves consumed by civil war or external war. Check the history books. This is what Obama said. Well, unfortunately, his own Democratic Party is steeped in this poison of racial superiority. It's something called identity politics. We take that, and then at the same time, we're going to add in the social and moral fabric of America in terms of where it's at today. And it is most definitely changing in unprecedented ways. And I would argue that these transformations could lead to revolutionary consequences. So there was a study done in Norway back in 2016, and it was titled, Do Ethnic Demographic Changes Trigger Civil War? And it studied civil wars globally from 1960 to 2013. And this was the result. This is what the study said. When the dominant majority has a relative share of 80% or higher, the risk of experiencing civil war is less likely. On the other side, a weak majority have a positive effect on civil war, signaling that when a majority is losing its share, the risk of conflict is likely to increase. So all of you are probably at least somewhat familiar with the demographic trends in the U.S., but the racial makeup is most rapidly changing. In 2010, a census said that whites were roughly 60% of the population in the United States. By 2045, they will be in the minority. They will be 49.9%. So that's 35 years from the last census. Interestingly, of all Americans 18 and under, within 2 years, whites will be a minority. So in 2020. And the fastest rising group in the United States are Hispanics. In 2010, they comprised of 9% of the population. By 2045, they'll be 25%. And we can go down the list. So obviously that's happening. At the same time, we have the implosion of the nuclear family, which we can all argue about whether this is a good or a bad thing. Look, there have been numerous studies that have said, what is the best environment to raise children? It's most definitely in a family where there's a mother and a father within the household. The number of babies being born to unwed mothers in the United States is over 40%. Over 40%. And we have to ask the question, is there a broad social price to be paid for this? If boys are being raised by their mothers and don't have positive male role models, what outcome can we expect? And that's a question all of you should think about. And let's face it, the vast majority of boys, whether they're being raised by their mothers or fathers or whatever the combination happens to be, boys are spending hundreds or thousands of hours sitting around playing first-person shooter games. They know how to kill people already. So that just makes you wonder, what are the trend lines? Where, like, in terms of the morality of what's happening there? The general culture promoted by the left is most definitely ascendant in American life. They control media outlets, and they're using that power as a cudgel, alienating this broad swath of what you could say was middle America. The left considers those who don't buy into the moral changes that have swept over the country in the last 30 years, the gay marriage, today it's transgender rights, things along these lines. The left considers these people to be bigots and uneducated losers. So I guess the question is this: how can you talk to someone you believe is inferior to you because of what they believe? How do you talk to them if this is what you truly believe? And then there's the big issue, and this is the one many people just, you know, anecdotally when you have a conversation, they always bring this up. And that's the Second Amendment, guns in America. So obviously, for the most part, conservatives believe in the Second Amendment, and they want to hang on to those guns, and it seems like the left wants those guns. So at one point, is there any sort of middle ground that can be reached between those two opposing groups? And I would argue no, there's not any sort of middle ground that's going to happen there. So as family connections fray, the trust in broader public institution is also decaying very quickly. Trust in Congress, religious institutions, and big business, they're all at all-time lows right now. And this is another interesting fact that maybe some of you haven't thought about. The U.S. used to be the number one missionary sending country on earth. As faith in the religion of their forefathers dies, Christianity is dying, so does the impetus to spread the message, this fusion of both Christianity and American political beliefs, democratic institutions, these sorts of things. So when you lose your religion, this is what I would argue, when you lose your religion and it isn't replaced with anything, you die. And that's what's happening in the United States today. There is one American institution that does command broad respect and has actually grown over the last 30 years in the public sphere, and that is the military. And my question is, what does this mean if the military is the most respected institution in the United States? Take a look at how many generals are in Trump's White House. A few of them have left, but there are quite a few that have been moved into positions within the State Department because retired generals are the only ones that can be confirmed by Congress these days because of the vitriol that's happening between the two parties there. There's no question that military influence at the upper levels of the political system in the United States is increasing. So I want to take a step back. In 2016, I was in the UK taking an interview with a very infamous British politician. His name's George Galloway. He's a socialist, and for the most part, well, frankly, nothing. I'd agree with him on almost nothing except this. And he said one comment that I thought was very prescient. He said, political flags and borders are always temporary, always. Nothing is ever permanent. He was referring to the dispute with Israel and the Palestinians as he related that. But I thought to myself, he's 100% right. So going back to this question, is the United States about to engage in another civil war? And I don't know the answer for sure. Let's face it, no one does. But here are the big questions that anyone that's saying that, oh, civil war is around the corner, these are the questions that they need to answer. They need to answer these questions. Who's going to lead this war? What will the ultimate aims be? And chiefly, what will the nature of the fighting be, and who's going to do it? These are the questions. So who's going to lead? Is Donald Trump going to lead it? I mean, he obviously, if he's impeached, he's guy. You know, it's clear that he wants to drag people as far, you know, down his rat hole that he wants to do it. So if he is impeached, you can be sure that he's going to try to activate at least some part of his base. But are people going to pick up their guns and kill their next door neighbors because Trump's been impeached? I would question that. On the Democratic side, who's going to lead this civil war? Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton? I mean, there's no one on the left that you could argue would be a leader that could rally all the troops to ultimately push these people to violence. And then there's what will the ultimate aims be? The imposition of a new political system? Obviously, I think if we look at it realistically, I think that's probably what a lot of this issue is about. It's about the imposition of a new political system, a new structure. But other ultimate aims, the genocide of a particular race? Are all white people going to round up all Hispanics and kill them all? Is this ultimately what's going to happen? What about an attempt to create a new nation with new borders, right? I mean, you could argue the first U.S. Civil War wasn't really a civil war, as Nick Giambruno and I were discussing last night. The reality is that was a rebellion. That wasn't really a civil war. So would the country be partitioned in half? Would this be India, Pakistan, and you have 24 hours for Republicans to go here and Democrats to go there, and anybody who's left after that, sorry, you're dead. I mean, honestly, what would the ultimate aims of this war be? And then chiefly, what will the nature of the fighting be, and who is going to do it? So let's just say we had some sort of an insurgency where there's a lot of bombings, car bombs, terror attacks, these sorts of things. Well, as I already discussed, in the 1970s, we saw literally thousands of bombings by left-wing groups in the U.S. Was there a civil war? No. If there's an outright war, every military expert I've ever talked about when it comes to these issues has always said that given the horror of the modern technology that exists in war making, millions of people would die if technology was unleashed the way that it could be. But taking that into account in an all-out war, there's some other issues that need to be taken into account, and you might laugh at this, but 30% of American teenagers and more than 2 in 3 adults in the U.S. They're all considered obese or overweight. So is it possible for a fat, overweight culture to explode in violence? And this is a serious question, because what does that obesity and essentially being fat, what does that say about the milieu? Where are people at in the country? And at the same time, America is aging rapidly. Do senior citizens have the will and the means to engage in violent civil conflict? So finally, one of the most influential studies on civil war conducted by 2 Oxford University professors argues that the causes for such conflicts, civil wars, are primarily economic and not grievance-based. Yes, some conflicts occur because of a loss of power by the dominant majority, that is true, but economics are typically at the heart of the issue. So if civil wars are primarily about economics, then how could a civil war begin in our current economic environment? According to a 2011 study, even the poorest in America have a car, multiple TVs, air conditioning, and access to food and medical care. And amazingly, the typical average poor American has more living space in his or her home than the average non-poor European has. And plus, if you believe the numbers, and I think we're going to be hearing about inflation in the next few minutes here, the economy is supposedly growing. Maybe it's not due to inflation. We're not really sure. All we know is it's not as bad as the United States, Venezuela. Most certainly it is not. But I guess the question is this. Is our current economic climate going to last forever? Can this last forever? And within this context, it's easier to understand why governments did what they did during the 2008 crisis. They were petrified because political upheaval always happens when there's economic disaster. So if we go through another economic crisis similar to 2008, which many people, Doug Casey, who we'll all hear from later on today, he's been obviously suggesting this could happen sooner or later. What's going to happen? That's a big question. So is the U.S. about to engage in another civil war? I keep on asking this question. And the media would like you to think that a civil war is imminent. But you have to remember, if it bleeds, it leads. This storyline, like a car accident or Stormy Daniels or anything that gets eyeballs, this is what leads, and that's why it's there, because we all look. So the question is this war imminent? And I personally believe, no, it's not imminent. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I directed a documentary for Casey Research called Meltdown America. And in that film, there was a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Mika Milkovic, who was he lived in Yugoslavia when the country split up. And this is his quote. He said, "Everyone becomes afraid when there's civil strife happening in the country. So they buy guns, and then it only takes one person to kill someone else, usually out of fear, and the killing starts. Civil wars can start with a very, very small trigger." Just about to wrap this up. So I was back in Washington, D.C. about 3 weeks ago, and while I was there, I met with several very senior intelligence and political people. And over lunch, it was very interesting what I was told. The words decay and decadence, as it related to America, were brought up more than once by them. And these are gentlemen who are, let's just say, on the further end of, they're further out on the spectrum of life than I am, much, much life experience, including many, many years in the White House. And the words decadent and decay were used, and I just thought to myself, are we witnessing the end of the American empire? Is America truly, are we witnessing something that's going to lead to some sort of potential political breakup? What's happening here? And really the answer to that question is really up to Americans. They're going to have to decide what happens. But to end here, I want to just take a quote from a book you've all, I'm sure, heard of by Edward Gibbon, titled The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. This is what he says about why Rome fell. The story of its ruin is simple and obvious, and instead of inquiring why the Roman Empire was destroyed, we should rather be surprised that it had subsisted for so long. The victorious legions who in distant wars acquired the vices of strangers and mercenaries first oppressed the freedom of the Republic and afterwards violated the majesty of the purple. The emperors, anxious for their personal safety and the public peace, were reduced to the base expedient of corrupting the discipline which rendered them alike formidable to their sovereign and to the enemy. The vigor of the military government was relaxed and finally dissolved by the partial institutions of Constantine, and the Roman world was ultimately overwhelmed by a deluge of barbarians. Thus was the end of Rome. Is America next? Thank you.
I think there are a lot of things that have gone wrong with our culture, but talking about civil war only exacerbates the problem, because the problem with saying that we're on the verge of a second civil war is that it actually encourages you to look at people across the aisle from you and not see the common face of an American, but see somebody who is your enemy attempting to destroy the United States. And that's not to say that conflicts between left and right don't exist. They do. And I think the left is dead wrong on virtually all of these issues. I think fighting leftist principles is a deeply important thing, because I think the left is complicit in the destruction of these central ideals of America that bind us together. I think the left has forcibly attempted to destroy the Judeo-Christian fabric. I think that the left has abandoned reason on behalf of subjective feeling. But I also think that most people in the United States are not, quote unquote, on the left. I think most people in the United States simply are told certain things by the media, and they believe those things because members of the media say them. I think a lot of people in the United States don't even think about policy very often. They don't think about politics very often. And if they do think about politics, I think they are driven into a state of insanity by all of the talk of this sort of civil war mentality. The war is on. America's on the verge of destruction. The greatest, freest country in the history of the world, most prosperous country in the history of the world. We're on the verge of chaos. That sort of talk, I think, makes things worse. I don't think we're on the verge of chaos, but I think that we have to look at the underlying trends and try to reverse them. I think that would be the best way to talk about this. We're not on the verge of the collapse of the United States. We are not. And Donald Trump is not a symptom of that, nor is he a cause of that. We are not on the verge of the collapse of the United States. 500 disgusting idiots marching in Charlottesville is not the collapse of the United States, right? Even the shooting of Congress people by an evil Bernie Sanders supporter, that is not the collapse of the United States, right? The United States is a lot more durable than that, because it was built on these principles. What is the collapse of the United States is when we forget about this common fabric. I still believe most Americans believe in the certain set of decency brought about by Judeo-Christian values. Even if people don't go to church, I think they believe in those values. They just don't know where they came from, which means it's our job to reinstill those values. It's our job to talk about those values, to talk about where they came from, why they are important, why people should go to church, why people should go to synagogue. At the same time, we have to talk about why it is that reason is necessary, why it is that classical liberalism, the idea that we are free because we have certain inalienable rights, why our reason allows us to have a republic where we can sit and talk together, why that stuff is actually important, right? Arguments over the tax rates are not going to destroy the United States. Abandonment of reason and abandonment of values are going to destroy the United States. And the problem is, once you get into a mentality that we are in a war, wartime mentality encourages people to abandon morality. People are at their worst in a war. And one of the weird things about the way that we perceive war in the modern world, because so few of us have actually been in the military, only a small percentage of Americans actually even know people who have been in the military or deal with people in the military on a regular basis. Because of that, we tend to think that war makes the best of people. When we watch war movies, we see, oh, look at the unity of the guys in Band of Brothers. Look how they came together. Look how in a war, there's a common sense of purpose. This is why so many folks particularly on the political left, like to talk about the war on poverty. People on the right will talk about the war on illegal immigration, the war on Christmas. We're constantly using the language of war because we think that war brings us together and refines us, that pressure turns us into a purer version of ourselves. The worst atrocities in the history of mankind have happened during war. The reason for that is because once you believe that you are fighting in a battle, once you believe that your life is at stake, once you believe that war is at your front door, you are willing to do almost anything in order to prevent yourself from losing that war. Once you believe that the country is one step away from its end, it's pretty easy to justify doing virtually anything. And I think that that's having a pretty significant impact, this sort of civil war rhetoric, on how people think on both the left and on the right.
People who don't know what violence is, it's like, here's one that people say, they'll say to a martial arts person, like they'll see someone like John Jones, like, if I was John Jones, I'd just fucking kick everybody's ass. Like, no, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't, okay? Yep. You know, and all the problems that John Jones has been in, one thing you should notice is never been in a fight. There's no street fights out there with John Jones. You know what I mean?
Like, I would bet he is the least likely person to engage in that activity.
I bet you're right. Yeah,
exactly. Because he doesn't want to do it, because he knows exactly the consequences, let alone the legal consequences of doing it outside of a cage.
Exactly. But when you look at it from someone who has zero understanding, they're like, oh, if I was that guy, I'd be kicking everybody's ass. But no, you wouldn't. Because, like, violence, people don't just accept violence. You don't just hit someone to get away with it. They think about that shit forever, and they try to get you back. And yeah, either they hire someone to get you back, or they get you back on their own, or they wait for you to not remember it, and then they come around the corner and fucking brain you with a baseball bat. This is what people do. People don't like getting fucked up. If you kick someone's ass, they're going to remember it. And this idea that you're going to be able to suppress people by attacking them and hitting them with bike locks and, you know, and not letting them speak at universities that, you know, you're protesting at, it's madness. And it's so confusing because it's not indicative of what I always thought of when I thought about left-wing people. I thought they were peace-loving people, yeah, or well-educated, and instead you're getting these people that are from their computer, they're calling for violence. Like, you don't know what violence is.
Well, the thing is, too, from what I've seen, it didn't start with the bike locks, right? It started with, you know, shout this person down.
Yes.
And then it's like fist fights, and then they're throwing rocks, and then it's bike locks. And now I hear people, you know, get your guns, and it starts to rise to that level. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
You people need to calm down, because the theory of, you know, we need a revolution in this country, like, let's pump the brakes, homeboy. Right?
Yeah. But first of all, here's what we need. We need camaraderie. We need to be nice. This is more important than anything. We need to be calm with each other.
I don't understand it. I don't. It's the exact opposite world to go back to, you know, getting out of the military and just kind of entering into the world. I'm like, what's going on?
Yeah.
It makes no sense to me. It makes me extremely uncomfortable. I hate hearing people calling for violence.
I know, and especially calling for violence when it's not necessary against Americans. When you, what you had to deal with in the military has to be the most intense form of conflict that's available on planet Earth. The most intense form of conflict is war. That's the real conflict. That's real consequences. You've suffered them physically. You've seen countless friends suffer them physically. That's the real. So when you're seeing people from universities, from these coddled environments, and these people with a really and completely ignorant perspective as to what the actual consequences of violence are, calling for it, it's just bananas.
On one hand, I'm glad that they haven't experienced it, because I can tell that they haven't just by the way that they're acting, and I'm glad that they didn't have to do that. But on the other one, it's a tough pill to swallow, because I just don't understand. War is a it's about as high consequence as you can get, for sure. Like I said, it resets your perspective. And the last thing that I would ever want to see is that here on the streets of the U.S. Like, I can't even imagine how destructive. Well, it would destroy our country for sure. But I also don't. I can't figure out the route out of where we are. So people are calling for violence, right? And you've got other countries trying to incite, get groups together. Like, what's the navigable route out of that?
Mushrooms.
Okay, I hadn't considered that route.
It's the only way. I honestly don't know. I'm hoping that things don't have to come to a head. I'm hoping that we don't have a Kent State or some horrible event in this country where, you know, protesters and the people that oppose them get into some horrible, deadly, violent encounter. Because so far, other than Charlottesville, that time that guy ran over that woman with a car, we're seeing most of this violence being at least somewhat contained to fisticuffs, right? And, you know, the professor that hit that guy with a bike lock, and there's a few other instances of people getting knocked out and punched and hit with sticks. We haven't seen mass shootings and murder, but... It's especially
when they're doing rallies and people are like, you know, let's do an open carry rally and everybody show up in their operator chic apparel with, I look at the pictures of that. I'm like, okay, you have a lot of stuff. First off, that's on backwards. You know, like I'm like, okay, you have all the tools, but you obviously don't practice with them.
Yeah.
But the danger of just, you know, what's the next step? First, we're just going to, you know, we're going to wear all of our stuff. All right. Well, if it started at fist and then went bike locks and then went, show up with your Civil War gear.
Right.
What's the next step after that?
Shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get involved in that. I mean,
Well, you picked a good spot where you're at in Montana.
Where I live does not suck.
Yeah. Hang out there and, you know, move in once the first few rounds have been fired and the dust starts to settle. The problem is
I would want to come off the bench.
Of course.
But the problem is if that happens... And I guarantee you I'm not the only one that feels like that. I'm going to get involved. And it's going to be a serious problem for those individuals. Because I'd give my military career a C across the board average. There's absolutely nothing spectacular about my career. I've done more than some, way less than others. But I've sacrificed enough that I'm not going to allow those people to tear us apart. But it's the last thing on earth that I want to do. But if they put me in that position, I know that myself and many other people who are in that same boat are going to get involved. And that's, I don't know if that's going to help the problem, but it's going to get ugly pretty fast.
I just don't remember a time where the country's been so divided in terms of, I mean, I don't know whether it's because of social media and because of the Russian influence on social media, compounded with having Trump as a president, compounded with, I mean, people that feel like they're disenfranchised and they don't feel like they're, like, you know, you hear about this all the time in regards to income inequality. Yep. People feel disenfranchised. They feel like the system has failed them. And that's why so many young kids are favoring socialism and why so many young kids are moving towards that. They think that anything has got to be better than watching these fat, rich cats with all this money controlling the world, and that the only way to get out of that is revolution. But damn, there's a lot of people that are not those fat, rich cats you're positioning yourself against. They're just normal, regular Americans who happen to be conservative. You know, and conservative does not always have to equal racist. It doesn't always have to equal white supremacy. It doesn't always have to equal all the negative connotations, you know, religious fanaticism and all these different things that people always attach towards conservatism. It doesn't have to mean that. It could just mean people who are prudent with their finances, who are, you know, they're cautious with the way they think. They're more conservative in their values and their ideals. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but we've got it lumped into these two groups, left versus right, and there's very little gray area.
It's the tyranny of or.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's as if there's only two choices.
Yeah.
You're either left or right.
Yeah.
Where's the and? Where's you trend to the left and you also have some values that are associated with the right?
Yeah.
Or you trend – it's
Civil War. Everyone seems to be talking about it, so we might as well get in on the fun. It's been said many times before, the United States has become increasingly polarized over the last few years. And in case polarized has become little more than a buzzword by now, what we're seeing is that the United States population over the previous three elections has grown more evenly divided between the right wing and left wing. At the same time, both sides have grown ever more radical, driving them to near opposite sides of the spectrum. Why is this important? Because the United States has remained united as long as it has, thanks to a unified identity. Politics were just a means to follow a road which would get us where we needed to go best and quickest. Today, however, the American identity is split near evenly in two, and both are driving in opposite directions. So is it not tyranny for 51% to exert its will over the remaining 49%? Precisely that seems to be the dilemma now faced by many Americans as the 2020 election nears. No matter which candidate wins, it seems half the population will be in near total disagreement with the regime's core direction. By this point, the disagreements and contrast in lifestyle seem to be so great that the only solution in the minds of many has become separation, be it peaceful or by force. Approximately 35% of Americans believe civil war is imminent within the next 5 years, 37% being Democrats and 32% being Republican. That number rises to 69% who believe a second civil war will come sometime in the future, but not so soon. The divide on the surface is red against blue, Republicans against Democrats, but there are more complexities to the two factions, which are made up of numerous parties who share the same goal, similar to how American politics used to function, as both parties have seemingly become their own independent versions of the American identity. On the right are the Republicans, whose factions primarily consist of the traditional conservatives, capitalists, constitutionalists, and nationalists, be they moderate or extreme. The most devout, active, and perhaps most dangerous of the group would be the constitutionalists and nationalists, both of whom are very likely to be armed, trained, and have military experience. Their general goal would be to preserve the nation as the Founding Fathers had intended, both its freedoms and historical identity, i.e. Protestant and European. The capitalists would be the most likely to flip sides, while big companies would likely only thrive under Republican rule. The tendency to sacrifice both freedom and identity for profit would make some of the colder, greedier capitalists untrustworthy allies. Now on the left are the Democrats, whose factions would be divided between liberals, corporate Democrats, social justice progressives, and socialists, be they moderate or extreme. The most devout and active of these groups would be the Socialists, who along with the Corporatist Democrats would constitute the most dangerous of the factions due to their great financial resources and the likelihood for the Socialists to be radicalized and armed. As with the Capitalists, the Corporate Democrats would be the most likely to flip sides as their policies may run contrary to those of the Socialists. It is also very possible for the Capitalists and Corporate Democrats to manipulate both factions while remaining secretly allied, waiting for the left and right to wear each other down so that big business can swoop in and establish a corporatist order, making big business a common enemy for both the far right and far left, should it break off as its own faction or more likely attempt to manipulate one of the larger factions. Another faction most people tend to overlook is the current US government, which would very likely retain the loyalty of most military personnel, as well as various resources exclusive to that of the federal government. Though, which side this faction will take may very well depend on which president gets elected, if the successor to the presidency isn't immediately overthrown, in which case the federal government would also be divided ideologically into two factions, a possibility which isn't too improbable. Allies are also another factor to take into consideration. Internationally, the federal government would retain previous alliances and put them to use, but if the federal government is divided, this becomes more complicated. There is a very slim opportunity for Russia, Israel, the UK, and Canada to support the Republican forces, but this isn't very likely. Support from Brazil may be reliable, as nationalist Brazilian President Bolsonaro has shown much favoritism toward the US, Japan, who has also been a close ally of the US and Trump himself, as well as Australia, who has historically stood by the US's side in times of crisis, are all reliable allies as well. Now, democratic forces do have quite a bit to draw upon in terms of allies. There are the more unlikely allies of China, Russia, and the EU, who would all stand to benefit from the US's destabilization, but there is also Saudi Arabia, Cuba, and of course Mexico, whose citizens within the US overwhelmingly tend to favor left-wing politicians. There also exists the possibility for Cuba and Saudi Arabia to provide to the Democrats a number of guerrilla soldiers and jihadis to both train and fight for their faction. Now, looking at this map here, you can see the Republicans would overwhelmingly hold much more land than that of the Democrats. However, going off population, you'll find the territory held by Democrats is heavily populated. Democrat territory is grossly disconnected, but concentrated to coastal and urban areas, cities. You might say this would make it very easy for Republican forces to simply encircle and crush the Democrats, but this could give us a Russian Civil War type of situation, where the Bolsheviks expanded from the urban areas in the west, captured major transit systems, and began spreading across the sparsely occupied white Russian lands. The difference here is that in Tsarist Russia, especially in urban areas, firearms were plentiful and common. Only after the revolution did gun ownership become exclusive to the left-wing elite. Conditions in the US are different. Here the right wing is greatly enamored with our right to keep and bear, and you'll hardly find any legal firearms in major cities. This, paired with the fact that many on the Democrat side are strongly opposed to firearm possession, a rousing 79% as a matter of fact, and the left-wing faction suddenly doesn't seem so intimidating. What this means is that the Republicans would simply outgun the Democrats, who, hypothetically, thanks to corporatist Democrats, could import more weapons, but there's still the issue that the Democrats would lack the training, as most living in urban areas have likely never even held a gun, let alone fired one. Overall, gun-to-gun, tactic-to-tactic, the Republican forces crush Democrat capabilities in a hypothetical war between two armies, but this hypothetical declaration of war and initiation of conflict likely isn't how it'll happen. Realistically, the outcome would be a lot more messy and increasingly drastic, in a way that you could argue we're already in the early stages of the Civil War, with our mass shootings, political killings, riots, censorship, threatening of controversial figures. And if that's the case, it'll get worse before it gets better. Many have often drawn parallels between what the Second American Civil War might bring and the Yellow Vest protest in France, but a conflict of sorts in the US would no doubt take a far less forgiving character, as divisions grow deeper than chasms, violence and destabilization echoing that which has been seen in many states across the Middle East for years upon years is more likely. Conflicts that'll continue to build until a separation is finally made, by which point the grueling task of reconstruction can begin, leaving the US and however many pieces it may remain to return to a pre-20th century status quo, focusing on its hemisphere, comparably to how Russia has become since the fall of the Soviet Union, making the US a post-empire nation-state. The US could well separate along a wide number of political, ethnic, and cultural lines, perhaps most notably would be New England, the South, California, Texas, and Cascadia. It is possible this great divide amongst our people could still be resolved differently, as every state of the 13 colonies was once its own distinct and unique culture, so could a reorganization of the US along a number of cultural, political commonwealths, with greater self-governance and autonomy, preserve national unity, while returning to a system which preserved the differing lifestyles of each of the Commonwealth inhabitants. But no matter how you slice it, the trajectory of the nation appears to be on a divisive course, one which is still avertible, but which shows no sign of slowing. And that is where I'll end this video for now. The US of Z, thanks for watching. Support your Legion by liking the video, or join our ranks by subscribing for more. Mr. Z, out.